Well, strangely, the sermon's actually about what it's advertised to be about, but I apologize. But first, a word about Jonah. A very interesting book, but to understand it, you have to go back a little bit earlier and understand that in a pre-biblical creation poem, God spent 5 days of the 6 active days of creation trying to tame the sea. The sea was a symbol of chaos and death. The early Hebrews and pre-Hebrews were not a seafaring people. They were a desert people. And they didn't become seagoing people till they got to Long Island and later to Marina Del Rey. And so the sea was a symbol of chaos and death. And all of this about being swallowed by a whale and into the depths of the sea is a metaphor for fear, for chaos, and to be delivered out of that sea, out of that ocean, which is a metaphor in both testaments of the Western Bible, is to be delivered from the controlling fear of the chaos and of death. Not to be delivered from death necessarily, but from the overwhelming fear. Now, to try to segue it into the sermon itself, that would take 3 paragraphs, so forget it. Let's talk about Janus and Janus and assume that he is somehow connected to Jonah etymologically and thematically. The god Janus looks both forward and backward, looking ahead in time to presumably where we're going and looking back to see where we've been. Now, in preparing for this, I've been reading a lot about time and the philosophy of time, and I've run across some very intelligent, well-educated physicists who tell me that time is an illusion and that we all only live in the now. You try telling that to the people holding my mortgage and credit card debt, that I only live in the now. You know, it kind of feels like Mark McGuire in front of the Congress saying, I'm not here to talk about the past. We are creatures of time. We can't help it. Squirrels may hide nuts for the winter instinctively. Prey understands who the predators are through genetic information. We have the ability to tell time, to look at where we're going, to plan ahead. But in order to plan ahead, we have to look in both directions. We have to see where we've been to know where we're going. Think for a moment, if it doesn't depress you too much, of a huge asteroid hurtling maybe towards the Earth. How would we know? If you just take a picture of where an asteroid is right now, you have no idea where it's going because you don't know where it has been. We can only predict or attempt to predict what is going to happen in the future by looking and tracking at where something has come from. It's not an infallible predictor of the future because, in fact, we're pretty bad at predicting the future. But it's the only shot that we have to have some influence over where we're going. As we stand just passing into a new decade, and yes, I know everyone here knows that decades don't begin and end on 0 years, but we're using everyday language since there was no year zero in the beginning. We know that the decade is measured differently by scientists, but we're just regular people in here, you know? And so we mark a decade with zeros, even if it's mathematically wrong. And we look at the past decade in order to try to figure out where we want to go. Do we just want to repeat ourselves and repeat our history, as George Santana said? Those who forget their history are condemned to repeat it. And there is that kind of inertia that we just keep doing the same old things because we know how to do it. We follow the same path because the paths have borne ruts in it from where we have gone before. We look at this past decade, and with it's a cautionary tale in my view, because we have gone in 10 years from relative surpluses to immense deficits in the United States. We have gone from relative peace, and peace is only relative. There is no absolute peace in the world at any time, but from relative peace to 2.5, 2.75 pretty active wars where Americans are engaged in killing and dying, and that's a difficult situation. We have gone from a country that may have been fat and complacent to one that is fat and scared. And if I'm looking at one thing in this past decade and one thing in our present reality that calls to me and that cries to me, it is the level of fear. And let me shock you, it's bipartisan. I might want to label or put some of it over more on one side than the other, but the fear card is part of the rut and the tradition that we have created and experienced in this decade. We are a people in general, I'm not talking about everybody in this room, who looks at the world and sees nothing but enemies, who looks at Islam and sees nothing but enemies, who looks at Arabs and sees nothing but enemies. And while it is certainly true that 9/11 was a tragedy and a catastrophe for over 3,000 lives that were lost, it's also a tragedy and a catastrophe for the courage and the will and the confidence and the freedoms that have subsequently been at least eroded, if not lost. We are, as human beings, bad actuaries. We are not good at figuring out what the real and great threats are, so we go for the easy stuff. And even really good people I know are scared to death of Arabs and Muslims, and as one of my fellow columnists at the Daily News put it, of swarthy people who ought to go back to where they came from. This is really scary. This is really scary, because to understand or misunderstand the threat as being somebody who looks Arab, looks Muslim, or in fact is Arab and in fact is Muslim, is to characterize a large part of the world as if you were going to characterize Christianity just by the Crusades and just by the Inquisition. The threats to us are real from a violent, militant, extreme element. But to create the broad category is to misunderstand the world, and it is to put a hole in our own hearts. Because we are bad at dealing with the actuarial threats to us. While the threats from terrorism are real, 30,000 people and over are killed every year in cars. 30,000 and over, I'm talking Americans here, Americans are killed every year in domestic gun violence. At the height of our gang problems in L.A., we were killing more of our children than during the siege of Sarajevo. But they were swarthy and didn't really make the news at the same amount. In a normal flu season, again, over 30,000 Americans die, and we are paralyzed and disrobing and being x-rayed and scanned, and I'm sure eventually cavities searched when they hide some kind of explosive powder in a body cavity, completely disproportionately to what the actual threats are. And what I want to say about this decade is that we have allowed ourselves to become fearful. We've allowed ourselves to just, without very much conscious thought, and people can differ about what is appropriate, but it should be done with information consciously, as opposed to, oh, it's scary, I just don't mind if you tap my phone, I don't mind if you pat my butt at the airport, I don't mind if you x-ray me, I don't mind because I'm scared. We're still, and this is from somebody who hated flying, who didn't fly for 25 years, I am no longer terrified of flying. I'm terrified of airports. I flew on Christmas Day after the underwear bomber decided to sacrifice his genitals to the gods of war. I flew 8 days later coming back and was patted down, and every piece of implementation and procedure was done. My bag was hand searched twice. I was patted down twice. I went through the magnetometer twice, and they didn't find the contraband that I had in my pocket. Truly. I was carrying a medical gel, and they guy pats me down. One's a wallet, one is a medical gel. Not interested, not conscious, not looking, not there. We have all the appearances to appease our fear without the reality. We have a fear that is disproportionate to our reality. And this is not a good thing for the individual soul, in my view, and for the soul of a nation to live in fear. England somehow got through V1 attacks, V2 attacks during World War II, got over bombing and kept that stiff upper lip for the most part and just kept on about their life. They went through the IRA bombings with bombs going off all of the time and lost civilians and lost members of the royal family, and they still kept on going with that stiff upper lip. Maybe that's bad therapy and it's not being in touch with the realities, but they kept living. They have gone through bombings of buses and of the metro, and their lips are not quivering, and ours as a nation are. I wonder at how easily we surrender, and I thought about this for a good deal, and I think part of it is that we are used to giving up pieces of our privacy and pieces of our dignity. We worry a lot about privacy and government, but every time we use a credit card and an ATM card, they know what we're buying. When we visit websites, they know where we're surfing. When we are putting our lives, and for the younger people who are here, and putting our pictures on social media, there is a surrender of dignity and of privacy that is greater than the x-ray machines at the airport that can not only tell your gender but also your religion. We don't have a sense of privacy and dignity as a nation. We've slowly surrendered it, and that may be bad, that may be good, but what is clear is it's unconscious. Take out your cell phones and your smartphones that are smart enough to know where you are. The next generation of smartphones is going to know where you are and the store that you're walking past, and is going to text you an ad that tells you that Charlie's is open, and come on in because there's a special for people who are carrying iPhones. That's not a joke. That's not a prediction. That's a reality. Our world has changed in the last 10 years in ways that we really, for the most part, didn't predict. The United States lost two great cities, New Orleans to water and Detroit to rust. It wasn't terrorists. It was us. We didn't predict the changes that technology would make in the way that we lead our lives. And this is the great flaw, in my view, of Karl Marx, who talked about the means of production, but it is the technology that so often determines values, and we don't think about it, and for the most part, we don't anticipate it. So that cottage industries were ended by large industry that created cities and factories. Cities were wounded by cars that created suburbs that helped break up the nuclear family. Our work ethic is changed by telecommuting, by all kinds of technologies. Our privacy changed by technology. Our values changed by technology. And for the most part, we don't see those changes coming because, not because they are unpredictable, but because in general it's pretty complex and we tend to be either frightened of a new technology and, like King Canute, want to cry, stop, hold, enough. Okay, so that was Macbeth. But by Canute would have said that if he had had the opportunity. We want to cry out in fear, or we want to welcome uncritically as progress. And I think the more difficult truth is somewhere in between. It's consciousness, it's attentiveness, it's making choices about our lives and our technology and our values according to our information. So if most of the major changes in my world, since I have been living on this planet, were largely unforeseen, the building of the Berlin Wall, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the going out of business sale of the Soviet Union, all the great technological changes, the miniaturization of data so that I can carry a library on an iPod, and the expansion of television from our original 9-inch kind of green set to, I'm not kidding, at the show, 83-inch flat screen with some 3D potential. I don't know that I want to see The Biggest Loser in 3D. Let me think about the impact of technology on my soul and in terms of these things. But we don't see the breakthroughs or their social ramifications. And they are, if not completely foreseeable, they are foreseeable and discussable, and we have choices. We look forward imperfectly, but by looking backwards, we have some opportunity of knowing our trajectory from where we have come. We can look at some of the dangers and look at some of the traps. I'm often overly fond of quoting the first premise of both theology and psychotherapy, which is not even God can change the past. But that's not completely true. We do change the past each time we visit it. Each time we remember it, whether imperfectly or more perfectly. We do change the past by how we use it. When we transform a trauma into a lesson that helps to guide us to something better in the future. We are conscious creatures of time. And unlike squirrels and prey, we have choices. Billy Pilgrim from Kurt Vonnegut's novel, Slaughterhouse-Five, I think. Yes? Okay. Is lost in time and lost, unstuck in time in an infandibulum. Well, we can visit the future, we can visit the past, but we are not completely unstuck. We look to time, to the past, as a guide, to use, to inform, to give us not control, but influence. And influence is enough because it allows us with conscious choices to have a stake in the future. And more than that, I can't ask. I want to be, as I'm sure all of us want to be, a player, a participant, and not simply an audience as other people write the future. Drifting from where we have been to some indeterminate future without input is, in my view, irresponsible. Believing that we have control is delusional. But in working with past through present action towards a future informs this eternal now and gives us heart and hope for a better tomorrow.